Hi there everyone, and welcome back to The Longest Night. We are a Game of Thrones show on the Podbreed Network, and we work with our friends at the Narth subreddit as well. My name is Rob, and I've seen every single episode of Game of Thrones at least half a dozen times.
And my name is Lizzie, and I'm watching every single episode of Game of Thrones for the very first time.
If you want to, you can find us on Twitter. We are at LongestNightGOT. That is at LongestNightGOT. I'll leave a link to that page in the description anyway. Our title music, as always, provided by friend of the podcast, Edward Thomas, and you can find all of his available work in the description as well. Okay, so because obviously we are covering episodes of Season 8 at the moment, on the third anniversary of the broadcast, the first ever broadcast date of each episode of the season. Can you believe we worked out our calendars like that? 21st of April, we're recording today, and on the 21st of April 2019, Season 8, Episode 2, A Night of the Seven Kingdoms, was broadcast. Lizzie, we had your story last week about you going past Primark on a tram and seeing the Game of Thrones range in the window.
I did, yeah.
Do you have a story for this week, or is it all just kind of passed you by now?
A lot of that time is a blur. I did kind of ask you in the week about any other weird Game of Thrones merch tie-ins. I'm thinking, you know, Primark and Game of Thrones, a bit of an unusual combo, but there must be one slightly weirder than that even.
And I gave one to you, didn't I?
Yeah, it was Johnny Walker whiskey. It was a Game of Thrones Johnny Walker collab called, what was it? White Walker?
There was White Walker, and there was I think it was Song of Fire or something like that. Let me just Google this for the people who are listening to me loudly typing right now.
For people who drink and know things, yeah.
Yes, why didn't they do that? Yeah, Johnny Walker, yeah. Song of Ice and Fire whiskey for people who know things and drink and know things. There was Song of Ice, Song of Fire, and White Walker.
Jesus.
Just, yeah, not the most glamorous tie-in, but apparently the people who've tried it, apparently it's quite nice. So,
okay, yeah. Well, is that going for it at least? Yeah.
Oh, who's that coming in through the door? Oh, it's Johnny Walker with a nice brown envelope for me. Thank you, Johnny. Okay, my story from the 21st of April 2019 is that I was away this weekend. My partner was volunteering. She was volunteering at a sports festival in Nottingham. And we went over from Stockport over to Nottingham. And she was coming up from London, I went over from Stockport, and we met each other in Nottingham, and we went to our Airbnb accommodation, which was a converted, like, not really a shed, but like a big shed made of concrete with windows, like one of those like back garden units that you sometimes get. And it had been converted, and it had a kitchen and a shower and electric and the internet, and the whole thing was about as big as one room. It was like, I would say it's, I don't know, maybe like 15 feet by 7 feet or something like that. And we managed to squeeze in. And we were there from Friday afternoon to about Sunday afternoon. And while we were there, we'd been out volunteering at the sports festival on the Saturday afternoon. Mm. And we got a cab back from where the sports festival was being held at Nottingham University. And we got a cab back to our accommodation. And while I was in the cab, I got my phone out and I looked on Twitter and I saw that A Night of the Seven Kingdoms, Season 8, Episode 2 of Game of Thrones, had leaked. And I was like, oh shit, I need to make a decision here, because if I watch it, I'm going to feel awful for watching something dodgy. But if I don't watch it, I'm going to get spoiled. And then I'm also going to feel awful. And so in a converted garden unit in Nottingham with my laptop hooked up to the TV in the converted shed via HDMI cable, I sat and watched a 360p version of this episode.
The best way to watch it.
The best way to watch it, yeah. And then on the Sunday night when the episode actually went out at 2 in the morning, over a day later, I actually didn't watch it. I didn't watch the simulcast. I was very tired after that sports festival weekend. We weren't doing any sports. We were just cutting up fruit in the sunshine and serving smoothies to people who had been partaking in the sports events. But
yeah,
we were still tired. There'd been a lot of travelling. And so I slept through and until the Monday morning. And I didn't watch this episode live. I watched it beforehand. And then I watched it 9 p.m. on Monday when it went out to the rest of the UK.
I'm surprised you didn't stay up to make sure it wasn't a decoy episode.
Do you know, I was thinking about that. Like, I wonder if I've missed anything because it's a dodgy copy. And I thought, even if I have missed something, I've got the essentials. So I'll watch it on Monday night. I'll give myself some well-earned sleep. Because as I said last week, I wasn't doing too well health-wise at the time. I was very tired a lot of the time. And so, I was grateful for that that night's sleep, to be honest. I've got a funny story about next week's episode, but that'll have to wait to next week. Have to wait for next week. So we're going to crack on with this week. This week we are going to be discussing, as we said, Season 8, Episode 2 of Game of Thrones, entitled A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. And it was written by Brian Cogman, his final episode for Game of Thrones, and directed by David Nutter. It was first broadcast on the 21st of April 2019 to an audience of 10.29 million people. Lizzie, what do we make of A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms?
I think it's a big improvement on last week's episode overall. I'd say the second half of the episode in particular is quite unexpected for a show that's usually more concerned with, you know, brutality and vengeance. It's like it's this quite beautiful reflection on the journeys these characters have been through over the years, about their sort of hopes and dreams in the face of near guaranteed destruction. And with regards to like the fireplace scene in particular, many of these characters would have been sworn enemies only a couple of years ago. They're brought together in this sweet but ultimately melancholic moment because, in the face of Armageddon, the houses they serve and the names they bear become irrelevant. I mean, we can't say the same for Jon, Sansa and Daenerys, however, but yeah, in that moment, everything just fades away and, well, all they can do is wait, but they make the best of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree that this is a huge step up from last week. Not only is it a huge step up in my estimation, it is one of my perfect 12, which means that there's just one left in the four episodes that remain. I think this is a gorgeous episode about how memory and experience and an ability to forgive is what kind of makes us human.
True.
I love the kind of eve of war, like the quiet in times of war stuff generally in this show. So maybe I'm just a bit biased towards it, but I really, really adore this episode. I feel like this is like the first 15 minutes of Blackwater extended out over an hour.
Yeah.
Or the first 15 minutes of The Watchers on the Wall expanded over an hour. And I think that, yeah, you've already said it, but this is the one episode of Game of Thrones that I would describe as being genuinely quite beautiful and heartwarming. That where Blackwater was like, oh my god, we're in a city that's about to get sacked, potentially, what brutality awaits us. And with Watchers on the Wall, it was like, we're just about to go in for a battle and everybody's talking about the people that they love and the people that they, you know, that they're attracted to and that sort of thing. This one is, because the threat is more existential rather than human, the thoughts get a bit more existential, and I think that it's the general question that hangs over this episode is like, what do you do when you've got a day to live?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And I think it turns into this really gorgeous tribute to the characters who made the show. I know there are four episodes left, but this for me is the proper goodbye. When you get a chance to acknowledge that the numbers of characters on screen they're going to start, like, the big names have made it this far. Like, if you've made it this far in Game of Thrones, you are a big deal. And the numbers are going to start dropping next week.
Mm, yeah.
And so this is the last chance that we're going to get to see some of these characters in a human situation rather than a combat situation. You know, regardless of who lives or dies in the following episodes, everything's going to be full pelt towards the finish. And so this is just the last chance the show gets to sort of go, oh, weren't these characters awesome? And then let them be themselves for an evening. And it turns into something that I think is really, really wonderful. And this episode has weaknesses.
Oh, it does. Yeah.
But I think I put it in my perfect 12 anyway, because I know that this was so lovingly written by a guy who probably just couldn't believe his luck that he was writing these characters that he'd read about. Because Brian Cogman was initially hired as a story consultant. Like, you know, if they were going to do anything on the show, they'd run by Brian and go, hey, just making sure you're a big fan of the books and you're a big expert with them. Just making sure that this is appropriate to your eyes. And then that's how he started. And then he got given episodes along the way. Wow. And so here he is writing a goodbye.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it really is beautiful. I think that it's an episode I really can't wait to really dig into. So, yeah, let's begin.
When I was a child, my brother would tell me a bedtime story about the man who murdered our father, who stabbed him in the back and cut his throat, who sat down on the Iron Throne and watched as his blood poured onto the floor. He told me other stories as well, about all the things we would do to that man once we took back the Seven Kingdoms and had him in our grasp. Your sister pledged to send her army north.
She did.
I don't see an army. I see one man with one hand.
We start at Winterfell and will remain there for the rest of the episode, where Jaime Lannister is put on trial in the Great Hall. Daenerys and Sansa both contemplate Jaime's fate after he reveals that Cersei was indeed lying about sending her army north. After Brienne vouches for Jaime, they allow him to fight. After the trial, Daenerys chastises Tyrion for falling for Cersei's lies. At the Forge, Gendry is creating dragonglass weapons. He receives a visit from Arya, who asks him about the progress he has made on crafting the weapon she asked him to make in the previous episode. Jaime then visits Bran and apologises for trying to kill him many years ago, but Bran holds no anger and says that they both serve a much greater purpose now. And back inside the castle, Jaime and Tyrion are discussing Jaime's love for Cersei when Jaime spots Brienne training men to fight outside the castle walls. He reaches Brienne and tells her that he would be honoured to fight under her command when the Army of the Dead reaches Winterfell. So, that's the first part of the episode, and I think that the first 15 minutes is all about Jaime. I noticed that it's basically, apart from a couple of scenes, this is Jaime just kind of working his way through Winterfell, apologizing to some people and reuniting with others. But yeah, what did you make of this first bit? What kind of notes have you got?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think that not only Jaime Lannister in Winterfell, but also a scene involving Jaime Lannister on trial in Winterfell, of all places, wouldn't be... you know, the focal point or the thrilling conclusion of an episode. Okay, it was last week, but we saw, you know, him making eye contact with Bran for the first time in, well, 8 seasons. Like, I thought the trial scene was okay. Yeah, I was a big fan of Brienne's intervention, but, like, even on my first watch, I didn't think there was quite enough tension to really carry it. Like, you think back to... okay, it's a big thing to compare it to. You think back to Tyrion's trial in season 4 and how it feels like a miscarriage of justice for an honourable man right from the start, and how that gave those scenes so much more weight than, you know, if he was just being given a fair trial would. like, given more time, they probably could have risen the stakes a little bit more. Like, as it stands, this huge moment in the show becomes just another plot beat. But yeah, we're in different times, and like I say, that does become a focal point of the episode later on, in that, you know, sometimes we just don't have time to bear grudges, and other more important things are going on just outside. And yeah, sometimes you do just have to, you know, cut your losses and accept that you are just human beings ultimately.
Yeah, I think I do actually agree. But I think that, as you've said at the end there, the show has moved past the point where politics really matter to enough of the characters. I think it still matters to Daenerys, and I think it still matters to Sansa, because as Daenerys acknowledges later in the episode, they're very, very close to coming to an agreement about what to do with Jaime Lannister.
Yeah.
And then it's just Brienne, Jon, and Tyrion who sort of step in and go, actually, one more person in our army could make a big difference at some stage, yeah. Even if it's just one more guy. And so let's keep him. We need every man we can get, as John says, and then the decision ends up being final. My interesting takeaway from this scene, obviously it's fair enough for Jaime to defend himself. It's great that Brienne jumped forward to basically save him in this trial. There's a little moment at the start of the episode where it's like, oh yeah, Jaime killed Daenerys' dad. And now they're talking about it. God, that's weird. But I think for me, the big emotional takeaway for me is that Daenerys here is sat watching people from the north, Sansa and Jon, and people from the south with Tyrion, and people from Tarth all unite around setting Jaime free, which is the exact opposite of what she wants to do. And that can't feel good. That cannot feel good. Like, people from all around the Seven Kingdoms coming to a decision, they agree on it, and it's the opposite of, in Daenerys' eyes, the opposite of justice. Yeah. And even Bran is there. This guy pushed me out of a window, and I don't even care. What do you make of Jon in this scene? Because obviously this is the first time we watch him and Daenerys appear on screen together after the revelation comes to Jon. How would you make of his behaviour?
God, he just seems totally exasperated, doesn't he? He looks like he would rather be anywhere else. And by the end of the episode, he is somewhere else. But there's no guarantee that he'll survive that.
Yeah, I love the fact that he's trying to avoid her at all costs. Like, it's almost quite comical how sick he feels about it, where it's like, oh my God, I finally fall in love with someone. I'm like, oh my God, I fancy my aunt. Oh my God, oh my God. And so, yeah, again, it's just another thing where, like, John's just like, people keep handing me these titles and telling me things that about myself that are supposed to be amazing. And they all just end up leading me to more trouble, where it's like, I got Name Lord Commander, and they killed me. I got named King in the North, and I had to give the crown up, and it was all this responsibility, and everyone who named me King in the North is now annoyed with me because I didn't stick with the title. Finally fall in love with this amazing, beautiful, magical woman who loves me too. And it turns out we're related. And do you know what? John's just like, I just want to go to sleep. You should have just left me on that table instead of resurrecting me, because all of this is just a mess.
It's like everything with John is a double-edged sword. Even in Grit, it's like, you know, you've fallen in love with this beautiful woman, but it means you're betraying the Night's Watch. It's like he's never had a clean win, I don't think.
Yeah, it's like every time something good happens to him, a finger on the monkey paw just curls.
That's it, yeah.
So there's developments later in the episode with Arya and Gendry, but what do you make of this opening scene?
Yeah, I mean, the word of the day at the Forge is heat. Like, ooh, I love the scenes at the Forge because, it's just, you know, in contrast to everything else at Winterfell, with this just icy emptiness, this vast, bitter, horrible, like, winter chill. It's that roaring fire. It's the glistening sweat on Gendry's chest, that slight bit of ash that covers his face. and the pounding of red hot metal and the come hither eyes that Arya makes at Gendry, and Gendry just clearly acknowledging it but also trying to shrug it off in a way. It's not a particularly subtle way of indicating that the two might have some sort of intimate connection, but yeah, it, like I say, it's a welcome distraction from the haunting nothingness that just whittles through the rest of Winterfell this week.
Yeah, I think it's easy to forget that, given what they've been through, they're just two horny teens.
And yeah, pretty much.
Gendry is hot, and, you know, Arya's got the hots for him, and fair enough. Arya does a little I know death routine, which is one of my favourite bits of the episode. That line, when we finish this season, we'll go back and look at the trailer for season 8. But in the trailer for season 8, Arya is the first person who speaks when she does the I know death, he's got many faces, I look forward to seeing this one. That's the opening line of the trailer. And so it's a line that's kind of embedded in my memory as being one of my favourites of the season, and one that really represents the season to me, actually. And when Arya does that little routine with the dragonglass daggers, he looks back at it, he watches her walk away, and then she goes, my weapon? He's like, yeah, I'll get right on it. And it's just like, he's salivating, and I fucking love it. It's great.
Yeah.
I think it's... God, they have such great chemistry, considering they've not been on season... They've not been on screen together since season 3. And they've both grown up and changed as actors, and Maisie's been in the show and Joe Dempsey hasn't. And, you know, they've come back in, they're grown-ups now, they can do these kinds of scenes. It's something that they can do, and it's something that the story can explore. And yeah, they both adapt to it really, really well. I love it. I think it's really excellent.
I agree.
So Jaime goes, and we're back to sort of Jaime, where he goes to visit Bran in the Godswood. And I think Bran kind of makes Jaime's point back at him, because Jaime makes that point about, this isn't about houses, this isn't about what's happened, it's about what needs to happen next. And then he goes and apologizes to Bran, and then Bran's like, well, you said it, like, we've all done terrible shit, but we're here now, we've got bigger fish to fry. I'm a weird mystical guy who can see into the present and the future and the past, and all of time is happening through my head at once. I don't have the space to be annoyed at you.
Of course.
Very philosophical.
Yeah. And like Bran, I'm sure in his mind, he knows that he's hardly innocent either. Like, Jaime doesn't know all the stuff about Hodor, but if he did, it's like, yeah, you ruined someone's life too.
Exactly. Yeah. They're not all saints. So, yeah. And then Jaime goes to visit Brienne after a little chat with Tyrion. I don't know if you had anything about Jaime's chat with Tyrion on the walls before he goes to meet Brienne.
It's mainly a sort of coverall for both scenes, but I did, like, at points in this, I almost feel like Jaime is trying a little bit too hard to ingratiate himself with certain people. It's like, is it just, I don't know, his main character complex creeping in again, or... like, does he know something we don't, or is he just afraid of the unknown or what's to come? But it's like, especially on my second watch, I noticed that there's this like constant hint of like uncertainty and doubt in Jaime's eyes, like on the scene with Tyrion where they're looking over at the courtyard,
yeah,
and he's sort of looking over his shoulder like someone's about to tap him on the shoulder and say, hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
And that's kind of capped off with Brienne literally walking away from his suggestion of serving under her, as if she knows better than to trust him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
What's going on there?
Yeah, I think that as much as the trial for Jaime finishes in that first scene, it kind of continues after it's over. Where
yeah, definitely.
Jaime has to realise a lot about himself, like, he's not the fighter that he used to be. Tyrion is sort of saying to him, like, you always knew exactly what Cersei was, and you loved her anyway. Like, it's an interrogation of Jaime's role so far, and, like, the characters that he has interacted with and how he's affected them. And, yeah, I do think you're right, that there is a little bit of main character syndrome always present in Jaime, and it's that he's done this huge noble thing, and he's ridden north, and... he's sort of like in the self-deprecating kind of like, I don't really care what happens to me, I just want to help kind of way. And he's maybe feeling a bit sorry for himself. And so Tyrion's kind of being a bit like, listen, you know, you've abandoned Cersei now, but like, you've always loved her and you still love her now. Like, just because you've come north, like, yeah, okay, you've done the brave thing and you've, you know, you're annoyed with her and, you know, all of this. But Tyrion's like, you've traveled north, you haven't changed. Like, no, you know, all you've done is travel north and it's only taken you about 2 weeks. Like, it doesn't take 2 weeks to change. It takes a lot longer than 2 weeks to change a lifetime's worth of habits. And so, and it's the same with Brienne, where it's like, she's sort of saying, you're not insulting me. Why is this? And it's like, Jaime's sort of like, I've changed, I'm a different person. And then Brienne's like, no. No, you're not.
No.
Like,
you're not. Yeah. No. Yeah, like you say, you don't just change overnight.
You're doing the honourable thing, and that's great. And we're great that you're making some progress, and you're not who you were in season one. But we know too much about you, and you're going to need to do a little bit more to maybe prove to us that you've reformed, as it will. Maybe fighting against the Army of the Dead in the next episode will help his cause there.
Maybe.
A little note as well that Podrick is training people now.
Yeah.
Good for him. So, we talked about this in season four, I think. You know, we love Pod on this pod.
We do.
And, we're always happy to see him doing well.
I thought you and I were on the verge of agreement before, about Sir Jaime.
Brienne has been loyal to me, always. I trust her more than anyone.
I wish I could have that kind of faith in my advisors.
Tyrion is a good man. He was never anything but decent towards me.
I didn't ask him to be my hand simply because he was good. I asked him to be my hand because he was good and intelligent and ruthless when he had to be. He never should have trusted Cersei.
You never should have either.
In the second part of the episode, Jorah visits Daenerys and suggests giving Tyrion a second chance to prove his worth, and also encourages her to speak to Sansa. Daenerys and Sansa meet and almost come to an understanding about the future of the North if Daenerys is to become queen, but they fail to reach a solution. Theon then returns to Winterfell, pledging to fight for the Starks, and he and Sansa reunite. Grey Worm and Missandei privately discuss their futures together, and they agree to travel to Narth when the war is over. Meanwhile, Jon reunites with Ed, Tormund and Beric, who have reached Winterfell from Last Hearth. Tormund tells Jon that the Army of the Dead will arrive during the night. Davos and Gilly serve food to a young girl who reminds them both of Shireen. And at a war council, Bran explains to the rest of those in attendance that the Night King is searching for him. A plan is laid to use Bran as bait in an attempt to draw the Night King out into the open. Theon offers to defend Bran in the Godswood, and when the meeting is over, Tyrion pulls up a chair to hear Bran's story. This is the bit I've taken actually the most notes about. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, so we'll start with Daenerys and Sansa. What do you make of that?
I've written, oh, hey, it's that Daenerys face from the meme.
Yes, it is Daenerys's face from the meme. There it is.
Yeah. It's the, you know, the one that looks like she's just finished sucking a lemon dry.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I saw it as Daenerys is trying to butter Sansa up a bit, and she's thinking she's making some leeway there. And then as soon as Sansa asks, what about the North, Dany's face just sinks straight away because she realises that Sansa won't bend the knee quite so easily. And we know what her approach has been to people who won't bend the knee in the very recent past.
Hmm. Yeah, I find it very, very interesting that Daenerys is giving me major creep vibes in this scene. Because I think that her need and want to make and repair a relationship with Sansa, that's real, and I think that's genuine. But the reasons for it, there is an ulterior motive with Daenerys in this scene, and it's like she went and spoke to Sam, and it's like, okay, Tarly's powerful family in the south, and now she, like you say, maybe trying to negotiate with Sansa, because Daenerys hopes to rule over the north. And
of course
I think this is where, again, we can talk about the difference between the experiences that Daenerys had in Essos and the experiences that she's had in Westeros. which is that when Daenerys was doing this in Essos, she was speaking to slave traders, she was speaking to people we didn't know. They were named characters, but like, we didn't know anything about their backstory. They were a bit, in my opinion, deliberately cartoonish, like Master Krasnys and the owners of the city and stuff like that. And so we were sort of like, oh, great. Well, of course, yeah, let's step aside, let Daenerys rule. But like, ever since season 7, it's like, I think I said it at the time where like, she's, and if I didn't, then I'll mention it now, which is that the way that Daenerys is with Jon at the start of season 7 is exactly the same as how she is with Hisdar, Joel Fry.
Yeah, and that's true.
It just, the way that she treats Jon stands out a little bit more because we know Jon and we like Jon. And it's the same with Sansa, where it's, we want Daenerys, I mean, do we want Daenerys to rule? But you know what I mean? Like, you know, we think that we prefer her over Cersei, and she's the only one with designs on the Iron Throne right now. So,
of course.
Yeah. So we want Daenerys to get what she wants, but it's butting up against the fact that we also want independence for the North. And so Daenerys in this scene, it's difficult to watch her a little bit because you don't really know who you want to emerge from that scene as the victor. You just want them to get along because they're two characters that we both like. But I think, yeah, Daenerys giving me major creep vibes again, though. Like, I'm sure she's being sincere, but I just don't know how good she is at it. Like, maybe she's really trying and it comes across as being a little bit insincere. But there is the doubt, and up it pops when Sansa says that the North wants to rule itself and that we'd never give it back.
Yeah.
You know, we want to be independent. You know, I want to complete my brother's, Robb Stark's, vision of an independent North. And yeah, I find that in an episode that's all about looking back and preparing for the end, Daenerys and Sansa are the only people who are sort of looking beyond what the political situation might be.
Yeah, that's true.
No one else in the episode is thinking what happens after, but Daenerys and Sansa are like, what happens after? Like, if we survive this, is there a chance that you'll just kind of let us be? Like, you can go south, claim the Iron Throne, that's fine, but what about us? You've been here, you've met the people, like, would you want to rule over us, or would you want to just leave us alone? And yeah, it's a very interesting and well-written scene, and there is something I want to talk about later in the season, but it's about how the female characters this season are used to make a point about repeated cycles
and
things like that. Maybe, like, you know, whether we learn from history and things like that. And
sure,
that there are lots of, you know, there are scenes in this episode, like with Sansa and Daenerys talking to each other, and they're put in the scene as polar opposites, and then it's about the discussion that they have and the larger war that's going on at the moment with Cersei and Daenerys. That's another kind of, you know, two women being used to make a point about, you know, they're carrying on a conflict that their husbands and fathers and stuff, like, you know, it's about inheriting war from other people in your life. And this is an example of that, I think, where Sansa and Daenerys have inherited the conflict that they're currently dealing with, and it's about whether they can remember that and whether they can come to an agreement and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But what do you make of Daenerys' time in the North?
Okay, maybe not as big a disaster as Season 7 was, given listening to our Season 7 review or more of that. But she's struggled to win people over, and usually I find she's, you know, she's not always been amazing at it, but she's found a way. Instead, it feels more like she's just found a new way to alienate people because, I don't know, that they see through her somehow.
Yeah, I think that scene afterwards where Theon and Sansa reunite is another one of her prospective kingdoms uniting with another person and kind of leaving Daenerys out of it. But yeah, Daenerys spends a lot of this episode, I think, realizing that she's not going to make friends in the North as easily as she thought.
No.
She's walked into an established, hard-worn, lived-in, stubborn setup. And like I said last week, she's going to have to work to win the affections of these people. And in the past, she hasn't really been able to win people over just by being who she is. There's that line in season 7 where John is like, they'll come to see you for what you are. But like, what is she?
Yeah, what are you?
And like, it's not just going to happen by default. Like, she's going to have to work for this. And like, you know, I mean, a big part of it is something that John actually, it's a big argument that John makes in the previous episode, which is that the North would be absolutely screwed without Daenerys right now. And it's bloody good timing that she came in. And so that's the, in the end, that's, Daenerys may see the war against the Night King as an inconvenience on her way to claim the Iron Throne, but it could be, looking forward, if things go well and if Daenerys plays a decisive role. Right now, I'm sort of thinking, Daenerys, if you can, you know, surely if you help out and the unthinkable happens, surely people are going to thank you for this. And that's how you'll do it. Just, you know, bide your time a little bit. Don't try and force the issue. Just bide your time. Let it happen by itself. And that's, you know, I think when John says that, that's what he means when it's like, she's magical and she can help them and she's fair and she wants to rescue people. You know, she forgives people in this episode, like Jorah's like, you know, let's give it another shot with Sansa. Let's try again. Forgive Tyrion. He's made some mistakes, but I've spoke to him and I know him and I know he's only doing his best. So let's give him another shot. And so Daenerys is, you know, she's shown in this episode that, and she's shown loads of times before that she is capable of mercy and forgiveness and all of the things that everybody else in this episode who's not looking forward right now, they're all capable of it too, and she's on their level. It's just about realizing it for herself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see it time and time again with politics. It's not good enough to simply be not as bad as the other guy. Like, you need something to ingratiate yourself with the people, and if that's fighting the Night King, then so be it. But who knows, that still might not be enough.
Yeah, well, only future episodes will tell us, A,
of course,
whether it all goes to shit or not, and B, if it doesn't go to shit, what happens afterwards. But
exactly. Yeah.
I thought the reunion with Theon and Sansa was really beautiful.
Yeah, and I've put, see, they can still do affecting reunion scenes.
Yes, they can. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would like to mention this as well, because people who liked to pick at Benioff and Weiss's decisions and the RIP, the writing on Game of Thrones and all that snarky shit that came in towards the end. David Benioff and Dan Weiss, along with Brian Cogman and, you know, the people who make the show, but Benioff and Weiss chiefly, they are responsible, entirely responsible for Theon and Sansa's relationship in this show.
Of course, yeah.
It's not book material. It's entirely TV show material. Theon and Sansa's relationship, the dynamic they have with each other. And so when people who watch this scene and cry and then say that Benioff and Weiss can't write a TV show, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Because they've just watched Benioff and Weiss and Brian Cogman and others build Sansa and Theon's relationship from the ground up. It was their own idea. They are entirely responsible for it. And if you cry when they hug after seeing each other for the first time in more than a few episodes, I'm sorry, but I think that's to do with what Benioff and Weiss did. And it's probably proof that they can write a TV show and that they can do it and that they can do affectionate TV and that they can do affectionate, as you say, affectionate reunion scenes.
Yeah, that's not accidental. It's, you know.
No. this is something that kind of comes in towards the end, where it's like some people are saying all the bad stuff is what Benioff and Weiss did wrong, and all the good stuff is what Brian Cogman and Miguel Sapochnik did right.
Oh, bollocks.
It's like, nah, can't do it, can't have it both ways. And
rubbish.
Well, Brian Cogman has actually spoken about this. He's just said, hey all, there have been several compliments, several mostly well-intentioned compliments thrown at me the past few days about my work on Game of Thrones at the expense of my old Game of Thrones bosses, who also happen to be my dear friends. So I'll just say this, and this is all I'll say. Yep, the showrunners are ultimately responsible for the stuff you hated, but the showrunners, and I promise you this is true because I was there, are ultimately responsible for the stuff you loved. And then he goes on and says, and then he says, that was supposed to be a two-tweet thread, and then he goes, actually, no, that isn't all I'll say, because I want to be very clear. That performance you loved, the showrunner ultimately shaped it in the editing room. That brilliant stroke of casting, the showrunner makes the final call. The amazing artisans and department heads that made the show look and sound and feel amazing, all hired by, empowered by, and in constant creative collaboration with the showrunners. That amazing moment from the book you loved, every last second of that moment adaptation, from adaptation to execution, painstakingly supervised by the showrunner, and that entire episode credited to another writer, conceived with, edited by, often with entire scenes rewritten by, the showrunner. Okay, now I'm done. And then he says, responding by listing the stuff you hated, completely missing the point. And so people will carry on talking their shit. Yeah, they are entirely responsible for that, and... Yeah, so, meh. So, yeah, Ed, Tormund, and Beric all make it back to Winterfell. Did you laugh when Tormund said, the big woman's still here?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, I know you're not a huge fan of the humour that they go for in this show, but, yeah.
No, well, I am, because they do good humour occasionally, but, right, I think you said last week that the show was... maybe beginning to acknowledge that reunions were becoming a bit overdone, and Tormund barreling in to give John a rugby tackle might just be the confirmation of that. Like, I'm not going to lie, I find Tormund to be a fascinating character, but he got on my nerves a bit in this episode.
Yeah.
Like, I don't mind him making puppy eyes at Brienne as a one-off, but I'm not fully on board with this idea of Tormund as this big... public school, top bands, rugby club, mad lad. Like, for me personally, it feels like a step down from his cool, mysterious persona from earlier seasons. You get a little bit of that in this episode in places, but yeah, overall, like, Tormund feels expendable. He felt expendable in season 7 when they went beyond the wall. He feels even more so now.
Yeah, there are a couple of characters in the show, I think, who have overstayed their welcome ever so slightly. And I still like them, and I still enjoy them on screen.
Yeah, of course.
But I think Bronn and Tormund, if they'd gone in season 7, I'm not sure how different the show would feel.
Not at all, I don't think. Not one bit.
Just a couple of notes about this bit. Game of Thrones doesn't do voiceovers very much, but when it does, they're always great. And John's in this episode is one of the better ones. Our enemy doesn't tire, doesn't stop, doesn't feel. That's another one from the trailer. The war planning scene, though, is when the subtext of the episode starts creeping through a little bit, when Sam says that that's what death is, like being forgotten. Like,
yeah,
if we forget where we've been and what we've done, we're not men anymore. We're just animals. And weirdly, that kind of reminds me of Coco, which was released before this. But like the whole thing about Coco is like, don't forget you're dead, otherwise they disappear. And making this whole point about like remembering where you've come from and all that. Really nice touch that Theon defends Bran and Winterfell when it was him that was responsible for its original downfall in season 2.
Of course.
And... I don't know if you took any notes about the Grey Worm and Missandei scene.
I did. I've put, he's tempting fate just a little bit by talking about the future and Daenerys winning.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like poor Missandei, she gets treated like an outsider, literally. You know, the two kids who...
Massively,
just,
yeah.
Yeah, they just... she introduces herself and they just walk away, like, looking sort of perturbed. But yeah, like maybe Grey Worm's just trying to keep Missandei's morale up in the face of everything that's going on. But from an audience perspective, that never bodes well.
No, it does feel a little bit like they're making that. It feels like someone should tell them that they're in a TV show. And if you make plans to go definitely. On holiday when the apocalypse is over, it's like, hello.
Yeah.
Are you not breaking one of the rules here if you want to survive?
Yeah, it's like getting married on a soap. You just don't do it.
No, not at all.
Can only end badly.
And the last little thing I want to mention before we move on to the next section is the glorious scene with Davos and Gilly with the little
girl.
You
thought that was glorious? I didn't think much of it.
I think it's just because I immediately see Shireen in that little girl, and the way that two characters from very disparate ends of the story are able to be pulled together and united by an experience that they shared with this little girl who was another casualty in this war of a TV show, and we were able to kind of just remember Shireen for a second. It's nice. I really do like it. That is the first moment in the episode where I start to get a bit like, oh, haven't we come a long way?
Okay, I get your point. I'm going to provide a counterpoint. They've already remembered Shireen a couple of times. Better than this. I didn't even make the Shireen connection on the first watch because I didn't actually notice her scarring. I thought the makeup on her was quite subtle. And it's only on the second watch I was like, oh yeah, she does have the little, like the red scar on one side of her face. But it's not like grayscale. Like I remember that looking on Shireen.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just saw it as Davos realizing that many of the dead, both current and upcoming, are going to be children, which gave him a bit of existential pause.
Do you know what? That's something from this scene that I'd not really taken before, because I get so distracted by the Shireen stuff, and I'm like, oh, God, Shireen. That I don't even think about the greater implications that, yeah, there will be children involved.
Yeah, we've seen what children can do as part of the Night King's army in, like, Hardhome.
Yeah. God, yeah. See, you're remembering stuff that even I haven't remembered that's slipped out of my mind. So, yeah, it's good. Always good to have a second and fresh pair of eyes on this show.
Last time you saw me, you wanted me to come to Winterfell. Took the long road, but...
What did the Red Woman want with you?
She wanted my blood. Some kind of spell.
Why your blood?
I'm Robert Baratheon's bastard. I didn't know until she told me. And she tied me up, stripped me down, put leeches all over me.
Was that your first time?
I'd never had leeches put all over
me. Your first time with a woman?
What? I wasn't with her.
Were you with other girls before that in King's Landing? Or after?
At a large fireplace in the Great Hall of Winterfell, Jaime, Tyrion, Brienne, Podrick, Davos and Tormund gather to drink, and Tormund regales the group with the story of how he became known as Giantsbane. Arya visits Sandor Clegane on the ramparts of Winterfell, and Beric Dondarrion joins them. Soon after, Arya meets with Gendry, who has finished crafting her weapon, and he tells her that he's Robert Baratheon's bastard. Arya then begins to seduce Gendry, and the pair of them have sex. And then on the walls of the castle, Jon, Ed, and Sam remember their fallen brothers from the Night's Watch, and afterwards, Sam gives Heartsbane to Ser Jorah. Yeah, another great section of the episode. I just love this from start to finish. What'd you make of the scene with the Night's Watch brothers?
Yeah, really good. Like, I do like that they took that time to just mention their names, you know, Gren and Pip. Like, as much as these were very clearly side characters from a previous season, it's like, yeah, they would mention them because they're friends. And they were friends from the start. So like, yeah, I thought it was good to reminisce on that, but also that line of Ed's, it's like, the last one alive, burn the rest of us. They're clearly thinking, yeah, it's unlikely that all of us are going to come out alive from this.
And they are the most experienced when dealing with the White Walkers. as well.
Yeah, you're right. So, and they're only like 20 themselves.
Yeah, it's not a wonderful future to be looking at, really, is it? Because that's that final shot where they look out over the wall just into complete blackness. And yeah, it's really lovely to hear Gwen and Pip's names again. Just like, oh yeah, oh, another moment where I'm like, oh, we've come so far.
And it kind of links with the later scene with Sam giving heart's pain to Sajora, because it's like, yeah, they're all men who've been moulded by Jor moment.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and the way that it's just after Jorah being, he gets welcomed back into the Mormont house, kind of, by Lyanna referring to him as cousin. But then Sam giving him the sword that wasn't, you know, it wasn't Jor Mormont's, but like, Jor is responsible in some way for Sam being who he is and where he is. And so there's an indirect endorsement there, and it feels warm to acknowledge the Night's Watch at this point, because they're the ones who've stared out at the White Walkers their whole lives, and well, on this show anyway, and they're the shields that guard the realm, the shield that guards the realms of men. And so that's something that Jorah acknowledges, it's something that John and Sam and Ed all acknowledge in their scene together. Ghost is there. I remember a lot of people being very happy about Ghost being there, because it's like, why wasn't Ghost in season 7? And it's because direwolves are too expensive. And so,
well, of course.
Yeah, so they put him in this scene just as a little like, yes, everybody's still here, don't worry. And so, of course, Ghost would hang around with the Night's Watch crew. The first half of the fireplace scene, we'll talk about what happens in front of the fireplace, the more momentous stuff in the fourth part of the episode. But I just love the beginning of this fireplace scene. It's like back to this glorious fan fiction stuff where it's like all these characters, we dreamed about them chatting together. Tormund and Davos are sharing screen time. Brienne and Davos are talking to each other. Like, you know, all these characters that you never would have imagined being anywhere near each other. Yeah. As Tyrion says, we're all in Winterfell now. Most of us have fought them, and now we're in the castle, and here we are just reminiscing. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, and like I said before, in another world, they'd probably all be fighting now, if not for this existential threat. And yeah, I do like the way they all kind of find their way inside as well. Like, it's just Jaime and Tyrion at first, and then like Brienne and Podrick come in just to, you know, get a bit of warmth, and like Davos comes in and Tormund comes in, and like you say, it's the closest we ever get to a bottle episode scenario.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, this is the closest the show ever gets to a bottle episode.
Yeah, and it's obviously not a true bottle episode, because it does go all over Winterfell.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's sweet. And then fucking Tormund starts with this story about breast milk.
Climbed
go away, Tormund.
With his wife.
Oh, I hate it. I'm sorry. If you like it, that's fine. I understand. If you like Tormund, I understand, but didn't need this.
I do find it funny, just because, like, if there is one character there who's going to break the ice with something very inappropriate, oh my god, it's that guy. Just before that, though, I think it's nice that the show pays more attention to the fact that Tyrion was so severely destroyed by everything that happened with Shae and Tywin.
Yeah,
they pay a better acknowledgement to the fact that sex doesn't really interest him or move him anymore.
Yeah.
Because this was a complaint in the fandom at the time, where it was like, oh, Tyrion's not been the same since the end of season 4. And it's like, no, he hasn't been the same, because he killed his lover and his dad in the same night, and then had to run away
from
his home.
After they both betrayed him, yeah.
So, yeah, you wouldn't be the same. It's a traumatic experience. And so it's nice that the show pays more than lip service to that, because in season 5, they have him approached by that sex worker, and he's like, I can't do it. Like, I just can't do it. Like, I'm sorry. Yeah. Something's preventing me from doing this. And so he's finally acknowledged that it's like, it's not really an option for him anymore, because whether it's emotional, whether it's physical, whatever, he doesn't have the space for it in his life anymore. And it's nice for them to, I think, pay tribute to the person that Tyrion has become. as opposed to just doing what quite a lot of fans of the show did, which was just wish that we had the Tyrion from beforehand. characters change, like, stories develop, sorry.
He's one of the rare cases in the show of heartbreak.
Yeah. No,
it's something we've not really covered much, is it? Like, we've had John losing a grip, but that kind of got brushed aside once John got killed and brought back to life.
Exactly. So it's good for the show to acknowledge things like that, and this is the perfect episode for it.
Yeah.
I think that the scene with Sandor, Arya and Beric is really good. Three people who spent a bit of time together in season three. They've all got physical and difficult scars that have lasted. They're sort of healing and they're sort of on their way to healing, but not quite.
Yeah.
And Beric is kind of like forever cursed to live through this life as long as the Lord of Light wants him to. And he doesn't really have consent over whether he's even able to stay dead. And like, and yet he still kind of lives his life in the service of the Lord of Light anyway. His choice now is just to go with it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, the Lord of Light wants me to do this, so fine.
I thought Sandor's little, I fought for you, didn't I? It was a very sweet farewell to their like father-daughter arc, with Arya figuratively flying the nest and leaving two miserable old shit birds behind.
Yeah.
And yeah, it leads nicely into Arya and Gendry having sex for the first time. You know, cats from the cradle with the silver spoon. Yes,
we have no bananas.
Yeah. Yeah, this is growth for Arya. And it's like, maybe it comes on the back of, you know, we're kind of running out of time to do any other growth. But yeah, it is like, it's easy to forget that Sandor did kind of save her life. And I think as much as there's obviously some bitterness between the two, there's also, like I mentioned in the previous episode, there's a bit of love as well. And Sandor does have at least some pride in what she's become.
Yeah, there's an acknowledgement, and it was something like that we saw in the last episode of season 7.
Yeah.
Where the Hound was like, I'm not going to get in her way. Smile. Proud dad smile.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's, like you say, it dovetails really nicely with what Arya does next, which is like, instead of, she's done her remembering of the past and now she's going to seize the moment. And this is maybe, for all she knows, the last moment she may have the chance to do something like this. And I love this scene. I mean, the joking and the banter between them where like Gendry's like, I didn't count how many women I slept with. And she's like, yes, you did. Like, and it's just, I love this acknowledgement where it's like, you're a guy, of course you've counted. Like,
you're like a teenage, early 20s guy, of course you did.
Yeah. And like,
how many can there realistically be?
And then when they actually get down to it, and it's like, it's hungry and it's desperate and it's clumsy. And like, it's all kind of like in the moment, and like, they both forget themselves for a second. And it's all like, need to have it now. And there's no attention paid to much in the art of foreplay or anything like that. It's just like, I is thinking, I've got no time left, so I might as well fuck somebody who I trust, and he's hot.
Yeah.
And then like, and Gendry's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll go with this. This is great. And then Arya sort of says like, I'm not the Red Woman. Like, you can trust me on this. Let's go. And then Gendry's like, yeah, fine. But my favorite shot though is the shot of Arya's scars.
And
Gendry sitting and looking at her. And it's like, first of all, he goes, whoa, she's been on a journey. And then I think it ripples out through the entire episode, which is that it's about wounded, scarred, broken people trying to have one last night, trying to be human, acknowledging everything that they've picked up along the road, all of the scars that we've seen them pick up, all the physical and mental scars that we've seen them pick up along the road. I think about all the people in this episode. And I think about all the people in this show And to be fair, the only people in this show who aren't in this episode are Cersei, Qyburn and Euron and the Mountain. And yeah, that one guy, Harry Strickland, but and maybe Bronn. But like, anyone who's anyone is in this episode. And I think about all of the things that have happened to them. And I understand that being a character in a TV show means that trauma is a prerequisite. It's kind of just something that you need to start your story. And if it hasn't already happened to you, then it's, you know, plot has to happen. So bad things have to happen to you. And I'm sorry. But like, I think about Arya's scars. And I think about the fact that sat around that fire in the Great Hall, you have Davos, who doesn't have any fingers on his one of his hands.
And lost his son.
And I think about Tyrion's got the big scar across his face. Andy's had to deal with the way that people talk about and react to his dwarfism. And I think about the fact that Jaime only has one hand.
Yep.
And I think about the fact that Brienne is a survivor of sexual assault and a survivor of what was probably quite a lot of childhood bullying.
Oh, yeah.
And I think about, a little bit wider than that, the fact that John has been killed and brought back to life. The fact that the Hound is burned across the face and has been called the Hound for most of his life. The fact that Beric is scarred and has been killed 6 times. And like, that for me is my favourite thing about Game of Thrones, which is that all of these things happen to these people and it never forgets. Like, the fact that Beric comes back to life a lot could very easily be seen as like, oh, well, he's never going to die. Like, it's great. But like, the guy has experienced death 6 times. Like, we're all kind of lucky that we only get to experience it once.
Yeah, that's true.
And he's experienced that 6 times. And like, it's something that tortures him. And it's not something he's proud about. And it goes all the way back to season 1, episode 4, I think, when Tyrion says, I've always had a soft spot in my heart, or like an affinity for cripples, bastards and broken things. And that, for me, is what makes Game of Thrones what it is, which is that it has never forgotten about the people on the ground. As much as this is a show about the people in castles and the people who fight wars, it has never forgotten about the damage. And I think that's why when people talk about Game of Thrones being too violent and gratuitously violent and excessively violent, I always think to myself, yeah, it is, because so is the real world. Like, as George R. Martin said, there's nothing I can put in my books and there's nothing that Dave and Dan can put in their show that hasn't happened in the world where you live. In the town where you were born. Like, in the country you're from. Like, and Game of Thrones has never, ever forgotten that. And I think that when Arya's scars come out, it's like, yeah, everybody in this episode has been on a serious, serious journey. And we've never been allowed to forget any part of it. And I think that's what really benefits, why the show benefits, I think, from not being something that had 20 episodes per season. Like, it just had 10. It means that you have, a 70 episodes of Lost is about 3 seasons.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, I love Lost from beginning to end. And the final episode. The final episode is, like, one of my top 3. I love it. But there are points of Lost where you're like, wait, how do these characters know each other again? Yeah, so when Arya's scars come out and it's just like, yeah, there's the journey. And it's a very beautiful way to cap off a great scene.
I agree. I couldn't want it better than you just have.
Well, thank you.
In the name of the warrior, I charge you to be brave. In the name of the father, I charge you to be just. In the name of the mother, I charge you to defend the innocent. Arise, Brienne of Tarth. A knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
Back at the fireplace, the conversation turns to knighthoods. When Tormund expresses surprise that Brienne isn't a knight, Jaime remarks that he could knight her right then and there, and Brienne is knighted and becomes incredibly emotional. And soon after, Podrick breaks into song and sings Jenny of Old Stones, which is an old song from Westeros history. And while Podrick sings, Arya lies awake while Gendry sleeps, Sam stays with Gilly and Little Sam, and Theon and Sansa share food. Down in the crypts of Winterfell, Jon, who has been avoiding Daenerys for most of the day, is approached by Daenerys while he stands in front of Lyanna Stark's statue, and when Daenerys brings up her brother Rhaegar's relationship with Lyanna and the history there, Jon tells her the truth about his parentage and what really happened between Rhaegar and Lyanna. Daenerys is initially sceptical about the validity of the information, but becomes upset when it sinks in, and before they can discuss it further, a horn sounds. The White Walkers and the Army of the Dead and the Night King and all of them lot have arrived. So, Brienne's a knight. What do you think?
Yeah, great stuff. It's like, is that the first time we've seen her, like, smile with teeth and everything?
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, bless her. What a lovely moment.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, I don't have much on it. It is just, yeah, it's a very lovely moment. It's a rare victory for a character in the show. It kind of pays off this journey she's been on for all this time. There's not much to really say about it. I'm still, okay, maybe still coming off this episode a little bit suspicious of Jaime, but aside from that, yeah, what else can you say?
Yeah, you are totally right. I've got the same note. Like, it's a culmination of Brienne's story, and I also kind of think for women in the show in general.
Yeah, that's true.
Because any woman in this show who has got a position of power has had to claim it for herself. They haven't been looked upon by their male contemporaries and colleagues and peers and said, you deserve to be on a level with us. And to be fair, above Tyrion and Tormund and Podrick, she's a sir, she's a knight, she outranks them now. And they were all there just like, you deserve this. Where Tormund's like, okay, I've said, you know, about Tormund maybe overstaying his welcome, but I don't think there's anyone else in this scene who would have been more suitable than to just say, fuck tradition, let's just get united. I'd do it. 10 times over, I'd knight you. And it's probably because he comes from beyond the wall where, there are definite, there's always going to be gender inequality amongst the wildlings, but it's not as severe as the civilized, in quotes, society of Westeros. And so, it's a woman actually being acknowledged rather than having to steal something or take something to be put on the same level as the men around her. And I do get choked up. And the other women on the show are, you know, Brienne is, she's afforded something in this episode that the women of the show generally have not been, and just because Brienne's been afforded this in this episode does not mean that the women in the show still standing will be afforded the same levels of status, because the men around them acknowledge their brilliance. But it's a moment, I think, where finally a woman in the show, like a woman in Westeros, has been, as I said, looked upon by her male friends and contemporaries and gone, you deserve this, so we're going to give it to you. We're going to use our privilege to elevate the voices of the marginalised.
In the on the evening before we die.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just at the end. How unfortunate. What do you make of Pod breaking into song?
So now we know why the women in King's Landing were so enamoured with Podrick.
Yeah, he sang to them.
he's got a very nice voice.
Yeah. And the tenderness to this is when everything with this episode really starts to sink in, when it's like, and they're going around all the characters like Sansa and Theon, Arya and Gendry, Missandei and Grey Worm, Little Sam and Sam and Gilly, and it's like, oh my god, this is it. Like, all bets are off next week. Like, no one knows who's going to make it out. Like, I remember the Deadpools before this episode, like, who makes it out next week? Who doesn't make it out next week? Will anyone make it out next week? Is the Night King going to win? And, like, it was, like, nobody, for the first time in a long time, I think it was a, nobody knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, literally anybody could go.
Yeah, and so when you're looking at all these characters like Sansa and Theon, Arya and Gendry, all these characters, and it's like, I have no idea if I'm ever going to see these characters again. And
like, yeah, of course.
And like, and I don't know if I'm going to see them survive the next episode. And like, Podrick singing, it's like, it's a classic trope, but it's used very well and it's used to full effect. And again, a load of people loved this song from the episode, written by Dan Wise. So, yeah, you know, well, 95% of it anyway, you know, the lyrics, there was a bit done by George R. R. Martin. The bulk of it was then done by Dan Wise, and the melody was done by Rami Javadi. I know you spoke to me in the week about the melody. You were quite interested in how the song was constructed, about how, like, how do you do something like this without flipping into, like, sea shanty territory or Gregorian territory? And
Yeah, there's a genuine skill, I think, to making a song that sounds like it's hundreds of years old in modern day.
Yeah.
And like I say, without veering into sea shanties or Gregorian chants. But yeah, you could feasibly, like, if you didn't know anything about the show and someone told you that this was a song written in 1300, you'd maybe buy it.
Yeah.
It's got that sort of, it's like, you know, you think of something like one of Bob Dylan's songs. It's a folk song as well, but it's clearly written in the 20th century.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to put my finger on it, but
I know what you mean.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally know what you mean, and I agree. I think that, you know, Game of Thrones, I think, is kind of set in a time period where, if it was in our world, it's about the 1500s, maybe the 1600s.
I'd maybe go earlier.
Yeah, maybe even possibly earlier than that. And so, like, yeah, you'd have to go right back to the beginnings of, well, humans singing and recording it and writing it down. And so, yeah, like, maybe the language is a bit modern English. Like, but...
Well, of course, the rest of the show is.
Yeah, it's, yeah, really, really just terrific. And then we get down to the crypt.
Yeah.
We get to, and Daenerys finally gets to Jon. She gets him where he can't run away. he can't just go, I've got a meeting to attend to. Gotta go to the toilet. Oh, is that the microwave? I hear. Yes, I'll just go
look over there. It's the Night King.
Yeah. what do you make of this retelling compared to last week's?
I did like this. I think the thing that makes this is actually Daenerys' reaction to the revelation. Like, she's absolutely right to be perturbed. Like, yet again, there's someone standing in the way of her quote-unquote rightful place on the Iron Throne, and it just happens to be the man she fell in love with, who is her own nephew. Like, yeah, you would be, like, shook by the revelation that this person who, you know, who you're in love with, who is also your nephew, is also the rightful heir to the Iron Throne, and that will turn your world upside down. But it's like, in the face of possible human extinction, the Iron Throne doesn't really matter anymore to anyone other than Daenerys and maybe Cersei.
Yeah, it's a very tiny chair when it comes up against the White Walkers, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, this puts a huge crack in Daenerys' entire identity.
Yeah.
Because this is the whole thing with Daenerys, the whole way since we've known her, is that the Iron Throne is her birthright.
Yeah.
It's my birthright. I was born to rule the Seven Kingdoms. I'm going to reclaim what's mine with fire and blood. I'm going to do this. I'm going to take that. And then Jon's there, and it's like, it wasn't her birthright, and it was never her birthright. And it's like, I just love the fact that Jon being this secret king is like this virus, and it's like, anyone who catches it has to spread it to somebody else, And then it's like, and it's just this awful piece of news that just ruins the lives of anyone who touches it. It's just, I find it so interesting and sort of funny because, like, again, I'll say, like I did last week, this idea of John being this secret king lying in wait should be really good news. Like, in most fantasy stories, it's like, yes, I have always felt something deep inside that I would have an obligation to rule my people to greatness, and everybody lived happily ever after. Whereas with John, it's like, what? No, why did you tell me this, Sam? That you just ruined my life. You've ruined my day. Like, it puts a crack in John's identity because he's always thought he was a bastard and he's not.
Yeah.
Whether he liked it or not, he grew used to being a bastard and he probably still feels that way. And it's like with Daenerys, it's like her whole thing is like, well, the throne is mine. It's mine. It's mine. And then John's like, sorry, no, it isn't. I'm really sorry that your whole life has just been a lie. And by the way, I know we're in love, but we're related, and I don't know how I feel about that, really. I know your family have wed, you know, sister and brother and cousins and stuff for generations, but I don't know how I feel about it. So yeah, it's a lot on Emilia Clarke's face and shoulders to communicate how she feels about this, and it's fantastic.
Because saved by the horn.
Yes, definitely saved by the horn. The way that it's told means that, but why I prefer it to last week, the way that it's told means that Daenerys gets to put the pieces together instead of just being told.
Yeah, you see it happening in real time, yeah.
Yeah, you can watch her realise it before Jon says the words.
Yep.
And it's like, yeah, this is way better. Like, I'm glad that she's just worked this out and we see her reaction and then Jon drops the bomb. And it's like, oh, dearie me. And that's why it's my favourite kind of retelling of Jon's parentage. Like, my favourite is still going to be Bran in The Winds of Winter and the subsequent beautiful montage that they play at the end of the Season 7 finale. But I much prefer this to last week. It's just leagues ahead, I think, in terms of how they do it. And I said last week, maybe there is no way to relay this information and make it dramatically satisfying. And it turns out, oh, there is. You just need to get Emilia Clarke's eyebrows squirming and get her face quivering. And then it's like, yeah, I believe in you. You're a great actress. You know, you play an amazing character and you've played her very well for all this time. So, yeah, well done on that one.
She does do the face syncing very well. She does it twice in this episode.
Yes, exactly. I really love Emilia Clarke. I think she brings her best stuff this season.
Like, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, I really do think that so far this season she's really brought her best stuff. I think that there were points during like season 6 for me where I thought things were a little bit patchy. But since she's arrived in Westeros, I think she's added a new dimension to Daenerys, as Daenerys' deeper dimensions have been explored and brought out of her by the people of Westeros. This kind of darker edge, this ruthlessness that's always been there, but we've never seen it exercised on people whose names we know. And now there's this where we may never see how she responds to this.
That's true.
And we may never know how she actually reacted to it. And so if this is the way that she goes out with this piece of news, then yeah. Great. Really, really great.
Yeah, hope it makes you sick.
And the end of the episode, I think this is the first... I know they do a lot of cliffhangers in this show, but I think this might be the first clear to be continued that the show has ever done, where it's like you could just put to be continued across that final scene. I do think this episode and the next one are kind of like part one and two of this same long 2.5 hour episode.
I agree. I've not even seen the episode, but I'm sure that this is a two-parter, surely.
And my opinion on this episode has been changed over the years by what happens next week, because there's lots of stuff in this episode that directly leads to things that happen next week and things that happen next week that make me think back and go like, oh, they've really done something there. Like, that's really clever that, like, across two episodes, they've kind of built something that has this long flow to it. And one day, I really hope to rent out a cinema room and, like, watch these next two episodes kind of, like, back to back. And
yeah,
just view them all in one sitting and see how they go as, like, one long experience. And I'm so, so excited to talk about next week with you. But before we do that, I want your favourite line of this episode.
God, I was between two, and I've actually still got two in my notes. I'm going to have to read them both, because one is longer, but one is very short. So, the longer one, I'll go with first. Jaime Lannister, in the name of the warrior, I charge you to be brave. In the name of the father, I charge you to be just. In the name of the mother, I charge you to defend the innocent. Rise, Ser Brianna Tarth, Knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah. And the other one?
And the other one is a much shorter one. It's Sam who says, I hope we win.
Yeah, I like that moment. It's quite sweet, actually, when desperate, where he sort of turns around and goes, oh, God, I hope we win. It's like, yeah. This episode is this eloquent and elaborate exploration of, like, the human condition on the eve of war. And then Sam just comes out and goes, I hope we win. And it's like, all of these long monologues and shit like that in this episode, Sam sums it up better than anyone, where he just sort of says something so simple.
And it's the most natural reaction, I think.
Yeah. I often think that sometimes about, this is a weird tangent to go off on, but I often think that sometimes about the Beach Boys, where Brian Wilson has this way of communicating sadness that's so, oh my God, the melancholy on Pet Sounds, like,
yeah,
when it just comes to, I think it's in Just Wasn't Made for These Times, where the chorus is just, sometimes I feel very sad.
Yeah, it's like a childlike way of expressing those feelings.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rob, we actually talk about that on Ed Thomas's podcast In Five, where I appeared on an episode where me and Ed talked about the Beach Boys for a good long while.
Yeah, so the guy, Ed Thomas, the guy who does our theme tune and outro. He has his own podcast that I'll leave a link to in the description this week, actually, called In Five, where me and Lizzie have both been on to talk about artists that we really love, like musical artists that we really love. And Lizzie, you did an episode about the Beach Boys.
So
go and check that out. So okay, your loser this week, who is it?
I mean, this was the hardest choice for a loser, because there's not really a loser in this episode, other than, I guess, Daenerys in a sense, but I actually gave it to Tormund just because, yeah, I got a bit tired of his antics after a while.
Okay, yep, I can definitely see why you would nominate him. I think, I know you, throughout the show, you've tried to avoid nominating people twice in a row.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I like, I'm totally fine with that. So who's your winner?
My winner of the week is Brienne.
Yeah, I think she's the character who gets the big emotional moment in this episode.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely fine. Okay, next week we are going to be back for season 8, episode 3, The Long Night. And, oh, God, I'm excited for this one.
Oh, God.
We're actually watching it together as well.
We are.
Yeah, we're watching it together because, as people who've seen that episode will know, I know what settings to put my TV on in order to enjoy Jesus that episode Christ. To its fullest. As instructed by the director of photography for that episode, who we spoke to at the end of season 7, Fabian Wagner, who was the director of photography for The Long Night, and one more episode this season. And his instructions were, just turn your brightness up on the TV. And so I'm going to do that. And we will discuss all of that next week. So thank you very much for listening to this slightly longer episode this week. We love talking to you guys, and it's great that you're still following us after 8 seasons. So thank you very much, and we'll see you soon.
See ya.